Blog Talk Radio.
East Coast, all my foreign people, my immigrants, both documented and undocumented. What's happening, Psyche Kessie, to bring it live and direct? Back on the air, it's been some time, I think about a week. So, you know, things are happening, but check it out. I don't want to take up too much of this guy's time. I've tried so long to get this show together. He's been too busy doing conventions, artwork, graphic novels, and whatever he does out there, and it's like, I always had to reschedule. Hey, sorry, when I get back to L.A., when I get back from New York, I'm at this convention, I have to be at this media conference. You know, I felt like I wasn't even worthy, man. I was like, you know, I'll just get some person from the street, you know, Skid Row, probably get more live conversation anyway. But check it out, people. Long time coming, long like Leviticus. We finally got Howard Simpson, artist extraordinaire. Known this guy for a long time. We knew each other by name only in this industry because we never got a chance to meet. Finally met, had a great conversation, and I noticed every time we had a conversation, it was always not just about art, not just about film, it was about life and community and stuff like that. So let me give you a little intro, a little bio on this brother, and then we'll get him in because I think he's still on the G4 private jet soaring over Miami. I'm just down here on 7th and Broadway in downtown L.A. But anyway, while attending Temple University's Tyler School of Art, Howard began his career as a storyboard artist for Action News and AccuWeather. He might be able to explain why the weather's so bad. But anyway, graduating with a BFA in art in graphic design with minor in communications, he later became an artist for various comic book publishers such as DC Comics, Marvel, Dark Horse, Valiant, and Disney. His storyboard work for TV commercials includes clients such as HBO, Forza, Mr. Brown Advertising, Amster Yard, Fallon, McElliott Berlin, and others. But somehow, during his artistic journey, Howard also taught at the Kubert School. People, the H to the S, Howard Simpson.
You can hear me?
I can hear you, brother. We had a bad connection over here. Our server went down, man. Don't worry, we paid our bills. Don't worry. We're covered. You know, everything's cool. But thanks for your patience, man. We had a server issue. We had to reconnect, go around a router, do a proxy, and all that good stuff. But whatever, man. We finally, hey, man, it's been a long time to make this happen. I want to thank you so much for coming on air with us and spending some time. I know, like I said earlier, in the Lear jet up there somewhere probably about Miami, hanging out with, I don't know, Denzel, Bruckheimer. But what's happening, man? How you feeling?
I'm doing fine. I'm happy to be here. Happy to finally do this interview.
So what's been up with you these days, man? What you been working on? You know, everybody's been asking me about ABBA Studios. You know, can you give us a little background on that? All right, give you background on you. What can you tell us about ABBA, man? How did it come together? How did you guys hook up? How did it happen?
Basically, it came about around the time I started being aware of the internet and realized immediately that there would be storytelling avenues open to it, open to artists. And I immediately started trying to put a company together to get some stories out there. Unfortunately, I was too early, one of those pioneers that ran away arrows in the back. Because, you know, there was, people weren't used to paying online and everything, and so we had books for sale, like, for $1 each. Actually, I think I had, yeah, $1. And it was, didn't go anywhere because there was no way for people to really pay for it. We used Bitcoin and other things that were around at that time. Not Bitcoin, I'm sorry, that's around now.
Right.
But whatever was around at that time that people were using to pay on the internet. But now people are more used to using their credit card. They trust it more. So, and now there are lots of people putting their artwork out there on the internet, putting their stories out there. So it was pretty much grew up the same time the internet did, you know. So,
you think the flow with all the people putting out work there, do you think there's still the issue of monetizing their work? Do you think people are just putting out there, just put it out there? Or do you think they're putting out there hopefully to get a following or get discovered or, you know, try to make some money? What's, how do you see it from your point of view?
Well, I think any artist always wants their work to be seen. And obviously if you can monetize it, you know, that's like icing on the cake. I mean,
right.
I've been talking with other artists. I mean, we would create whether someone was paying us or not. You know, and now you have a level playing field with the internet, because if you have a story you want to tell, you could put it out there for everybody to see. So far, I think that that's a great thing. I mean, I found so much work by so many different people that
right.
I probably never would have seen otherwise. And also a publisher may not even have published it, you know, because
right.
it's just different. And also they're just expressing themselves.
Now with the expression, it comes back to something that we had touched on some time ago, and I think we've heard in our respective circles. When, you know, when the compos are out there, a lot of us, you know, you're an artist, penciler, inker, colorist, I mean, you do the whole spectrum. My main thing is mostly writing, which is stressful enough as it is, but fun. But I've always, I know the conversation's always been production value, and I think I've seen people put books out. And, you know, I've never met other artists who dog other artists, so it's not even a nasty critique, but do you feel that there are times that when people would put their books out in hardcover, in hard copy, there wasn't attention to detail or quality of art. And now you think that's prevailing also now that it's easier to put it out online. Upload, send. But there's no attention to detail and quality. Does that make sense to you, brother?
Yeah, that's a pretty long statement or a question. I'm not sure which it is. But,
how we get,
man. Yeah. But I think, I mean, as far as attention to detail, I mean, that's every artist's own decision as what they want to do. And detail can be different things. I mean, because somebody could put five lines down and that's all they need, you know, whereas,
right.
you know, I may need to put 100 lines down.
Right.
And that's what I need to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as production values, I mean, that's definitely a concern because some people are learning how to use a computer at the same time they're trying to, you know, put the artwork up there.
Right.
You know, there's scanning issues or whether you create your work digitally or not, you know, so it's clean. So, yeah, there's a different variety of and levels of attention to detail, as you say.
Right.
And I'm not talking about the talent at this point, you know, whether somebody's
right.
a good artist or a bad artist or a mediocre
right.
artist. I'm just talking about, you know, when, just the presentation of the work. And that's one thing, too. There's a lot of different ways to present the work online. Some have some dedicated apps. You know, there's some great companies out that are doing some great things. Comixology used to be at the top of the list, but since Amazon bought them,
I've been hearing.
They've changed their paradigm.
Have they really? Can you speak on that
yeah.
or enlighten or touch on a little bit?
I mean, it was a great app, you know, that I could use on the iPad or the phone. And once Amazon bought it, you can't buy from the store anymore through the app. You have to do it online if you want to purchase a comic book. So, I mean, the reading experience is still the same, but if I'm on my iPad, I can't just buy a book like I used to.
Right,
so,
right.
you know, and I don't know whether Amazon is trying to get people just to get used to buying online and then switch them to their platform, you know, to Kindle.
Right.
So it's a mystery right now. But as far as some of the other things that you have, you know, independent readers that can do like Comic Book Lover, you have Made in Fire that's out there, you know, which is pretty good.
Nice.
And also there are some that created apps just for the comics themselves, you know, like Wormwood, Scroll On, Nico, which is actually, I really don't like motion comics, But right. I think Nico does it pretty well. That's N-I-K-O. Mm-hmm. And they do a pretty good job of that.
What was it about Motion Comics that kind of throws you off?
Well, the main thing about Motion Comics is I always seem to flash back to those those 60s Marvel
Spider-Man.
Cartoons where they had, you know, those the Jack Kirby panels, and they would move an arm and animate or slide a character across the screen. So some of those
Hulk
were really at that level.
Hulk would take one step and slide like five panels.
Yeah.
Like God. Actually, I can agree with that. I can attest to that. But you said it was a Nico you referenced. You said they do a lot better.
Yeah, this is done by an animator. And mm-hmm. Let me see if I give him proper credit and remember the name. Let's see. Well, I can't remember the name off the top of my head right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's N-I-K-O. And... It's a really good comic book. I mean, because it's by an animator, so obviously he would be able to do animation very well. But he picks his moment. He does it within the panels, which I think is really good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very different, and it's one of the few, quote, I don't even know if I should call it a motion comic, but that's if I was to call it a motion comic, I would call that one.
Okay. Is that Nico and the Sword of Light?
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
What is that guy? I know he did a Kickstarter or something like that some time ago.
A Kickstarter funded this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what who's that? Imagination, I think it's Imagination Studios. So I'm not too sure, but I know you're talking about. Yes, I remember that. Yeah. What you're talking about back in the day. Respect. You think with Comicsology being bought by Amazon, do you think there's still room in the space for another Comicsology, or what's your vibe on that? Because just them, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's always space for somebody to do something different. Just like, you know, when the internet was young and Yahoo was the only search engine, and the other ones came along, you know, some fell by the wayside, and then next, you know, Google became the search engine. So
right.
Somebody can always find a way to approach the technology different, and technology is always changing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think there's always room for another Comicsology, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, you really don't need another Comicsology. I mean, you just need something where creators can just put their work forth, so that they can share it with people. And whether that's monetized or free,
right.
You know, it could be either one. You know, I mean, a lot of times the internet audience expects everything to be free. So one way to monetize it is to, you know, have advertising in your comic. And I haven't really seen a lot of that online yet, but I think it may happen sooner or later.
Yeah, it's kind of like how MySpace was just, it was MySpace, and you saw half the page was nothing but ads, and you saw your little sign
in
the bottom. Hey, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Let's go one step further from motion comics into film. You know, the biggest thing right now, obviously, is, you know, events, you know, all these properties, these IPs. For those that don't know intellectual property, so warning my listeners out there, we may switch into, like, you know, terminology. If you're not familiar, just send me a chat or a text, whatever. But, you know, we're seeing a lot of these intellectual properties, mainly from, you know, Marvel, DC's doing what they're doing on the television. But do you think that with the – okay, let me come back. Comic-Con used to go back there back in the day. So when I say it used to be for the artists until Hollywood started creeping down there. And it seemed like back in the day, the artist was there to sell their artwork, promote their art, promote their book or their collaborations. Now it seems, as I walk some of the floors, they're there to have their product, hoping that some producer will buy their IP to make it into a movie. Do you see somehow with all these movies, you know, not just the Avengers, but even like the low-budget ones, affecting how the reasons why comic books are being produced in the first place? Like, I'll produce this book to get a film, or what's your vibe on that?
Well, just to clarify for the audience, we talk about San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah.
And, there was a time in the past, as you say, where the comics and the creators used to be the focus of the show. I mean, we would be in the center of the floor. Now, once Hollywood started stepping around and seeing that there was money to be made there and the audience that they could capture and promote to, now it seems like the comics, the comic book stores, publishers, and the creators are all pushed along the side, mm-hmm. Kind of as an afterthought. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fed into, for some creators also, to them thinking that now they can get into Hollywood. They can have a film made or a TV show made.
Right.
And I think the problem is that they're so focused on that, they're not really focused on creating a good comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're thinking of the end product as a film or a movie. And
right.
and just walking on the floor nowadays, you can just hear people talking about, I want to shop this around as a movie. People would just produce a first issue just to get or one, maybe not even first, but just one issue,
mm-hmm.
just to try to shop it around to find a producer or somebody that's interested in making it as a movie.
Right, right.
And in some cases, it is happening. I mean, because you have some comics that aren't even finished their run to get options. Now, options
mm-hmm.
aren't anything special. I mean, your material can get optioned, and it won't be made for 5 years, and then it's locked up, and then you can't do anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
These things happen. Because I remember there was this property called Scud. It was a robot.
Right.
Robot.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard that had been optioned, but I still haven't seen anything come out yet. So things like that happen.
For those out there that aren't aware what option is, what that means is I have a studio puts out a book, and my company comes down and says, hey, gentlemen, we'll give you $1,000 for the exclusive rights to that book to make into a film. We'll negotiate. Maybe we'll have those rights for 2 years. So now I have the exclusive to make their product into a movie. These guys can go put in the press releases, book option, this, that, and that's pretty much what it is. There's no guarantee we'll make the film, but at least they got the money, we got the option, and oftentimes it goes nowhere. So for those that weren't sure what an option is, that's pretty much the ABC of what an option is. So there you go.
Yeah.
I think I covered that right, Ryan? Yeah. It's interesting because I remember I may have shared with you one of our numerous conversations, I think it was last year, where they had I think Kevin was on the panel, Grievous, and some other brothers and sisters in terms of, fellow artists from Lightstorm, Cameron's company and the other companies like that. And I think Palmiotti was up there as well. And I remember he was talking about somebody had asked the question, how do you feel about all these comic books, being made into movies, and how do you think the process has changed? And almost to a person, they were saying that the process, they love the fact that comic books are not getting the love. Palmiotti said that it's always been cool to be the geek anyways, so now all of a sudden geeks are cool. But I remember almost to a person, they were all saying that they like that comic book to get attention, but what they don't like is when people come with their IP properties to them with, one issue, and they look at the comic book and say, okay, where's the next issue? And the creator says, well, that's it. And they were saying this because it turned out every guy on the panel, and I think it was a woman as well, grew up on comic books from back in the day, so they had a respect and love and understanding of the craft, and they kind of felt that people weren't respecting it by not even making the effort to give a full story. It goes back to what you were saying. Let's just do one issue and hope we can get an option. So, I don't know, bro.
Yeah, and, I mean, and sadly, just to dovetail what you're saying, and sadly, it's only in America where comics were created, one of the true American art forms along with jazz,
mm-hmm.
that comics don't get the love, and yes, it is good that the movies out there are making it more, quote unquote, acceptable to read comic books in public. I never had a problem with that, but some people, were embarrassed, or people looked at you like, what are you reading little kids stuff for?
Mm-hmm.
Now with the quote unquote intellectual term graphic novel, it's more acceptable to the mainstream now.
Mm-hmm.
Now the thing is though that there are still, it's hard to find comic books. So even with the acceptance, if someone wants to, comics are still kind of relegated to the comic book store. And even though some of the larger book chains are carrying the graphic novels and trade paperbacks, and there's a big difference between trade paperback and graphic novel. Everything is in a graphic novel.
Right.
A graphic novel is an original work created to be published in that format. Trade paperback is a collection of reprints of previously published work. So they look kind of the same. So to the eye, you can tell the difference, but it's the content that makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you have to go to a bookstore, but you'll just be getting graphic novels there or trade paperbacks. Whereas if comics were more available, you know, being sold in drugstores again or at supermarkets or, you know, places where you could just run into comics. Like as a kid, you know, I just saw a comic book in a store on a rack, on the spinner rack.
Not the spinner rack.
And that was my introduction to this whole world of comic books. Well, actually, that was my first introduction. I found some comic books in this house we had moved into in the basement, and then I found that they were sold at stores. Because when I found them in the basement, I thought, well, that was it. I didn't know they were out there in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was like a big surprise. So you can't stumble upon a comic book store. You have to. It's a destination store. You have to decide you're going to go there. You have to already decide you're going to buy a comic, find a store, and go there and buy it.
Right.
You know, I mean, we need more comics in Walmarts and K-Bars and stuff like that. We need more out there so we can take advantage of this newfound respect or newfound audience.
Right.
Because, sadly, right now what's happening is even though, you know, Avengers is the most popular movie, one of the best that's come out so far, well, along with Dark Knight, it doesn't really increase the sales because it's still only sold to that we'll call it a big pie of comic book fans.
Right.
So that pie is always going to buy comics. We haven't increased it at all.
Something you brought up, I think, you know, you talk about respect because this is going to be a two-prong. Let's go back to this the spinorama because I was getting very nostalgic. it seems like there was an obvious respect, or maybe it was making money for the store, because the one thing about, okay, for all you cats out there that don't know what a spinorama is, but it's kind of like throwing the name up there, it was this round, it was a cylindrical-shaped bookshelf made out of white metal that the comic books would be placed in, so you could spin it around and see your comic books. It was usually about 8 or 9 levels up, for those that don't know. Now, some of the old school cats are like, oh, please, we know that. I got one in my living room, almost like that. But the one thing I noticed back then when you brought it up is that the first thing that came to mind is that no matter what store you walked in, drugstore, whatever, they were usually right inside the door when you walked in. They weren't like way in the back or by the prescription. They were literally when you went right there to the left or the right. So, and there was respect then. So I lead that into, I understand how in overseas, you know, people read comic books, wherever they are, or as books, grown man, young, anywhere, why do you think there is more of a respect for the medium abroad than there was here?
Well, unfortunately, here we had Wortham, who produced his book that kind of sent into the Dark Ages, you know. So by writing Seduction of the Innocent and then, you know, having these committee hearings, you know, saying that our children's minds were being poisoned by comics, and that really did comics in. I mean, because before then, you did have adults reading comics. I mean, because the EC comics were not written for kids. But also at that time, there were a lot of different genres out. I mean, you didn't just have superheroes. You had westerns, you had horror, you had science fiction, you had romance. You had the humor strips, you had, you know, the Archie-type strips, and there was a vast variety. And now we've kind of, I mean, for the mainstream publishing, it's kind of been relegated to superheroes. I mean, you have to go to the smaller independent publishers or independent creators to find any variety. And so once it became a superhero ghetto, so to speak, that kind of, and also because where you kind of, with the publicity, comics are for kids.
Right.
And in everybody's mind, it became comics are for kids, whereas where in the rest of the world, comics are still being sold all over to everybody, you know, from 8 to 80. I mean, to this day, that's still the case. I mean, also, they have newsstands. You could find comics almost anywhere, you know, graphic novels anywhere to pick up stuff. And they have more different formats. I mean, I was in Italy, and I was just amazed at how many different formats. They had the magazine style, digest style. It was an eye opener to me. You know what I mean? Because Europe is probably 10 years ahead of us as far as the material being published and how it's being published. Even Japan, I mean, they have these telephone style books that they produce weekly, you know, in black and white.
Right.
I mean, it's just the variety is just amazing. And I mean, we're so far behind what the rest of the world is doing with comic books and seeing the possibilities that it can have.
Yeah, and I think availability is interesting because I know we've touched on this, that between the area where you reside in L.A. and I reside in L.A., there's not one comic book. No place. There's no place. I think the closest one is maybe Golden Apple in Hollywood, way down Sunset.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's like the journey to Mecca to go to that place.
Yeah, and even the few newsstands that are around, they don't carry comic books.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, comic books became the reason they stopped newsstand distribution because comic books weren't cost effective, against magazines. I mean, nowadays they're probably cost effective because the prices are so expensive.
Right. Still only $8.
Yeah. Yeah.
How you see this whole Charlie? How you see going from comics to film and just the creative expression overall? Do you see a trend happening now? I know you had mentioned Avengers. Well, you mentioned Avengers. Why do you think Avengers even worked when so many other films, with solo characters, Punisher, stuff like that, struggle? We're not talking about the Howard the Ducks of the world. We're talking about, other films. But why do you feel, why do you think Avengers worked when you had not just, they weren't like C-listed characters. These were the A-listers. And we can't, we have to make sure we give love to Blade, who set it off in the first place. Why do you think Avengers worked?
Well, Avengers worked for the same reason that Marvel Comics worked and became popular in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
They did something that nobody else was doing, which is you take all your heroes who were in separate stories and cross them over and make sure they're part of the same universe. Mm-hmm. So Marvel did in the 60s. That Thor flying through Spider-Man's book, just in one panel.
Sure.
Just something to say, hey, wow, they're in the same world. Mm-hmm. And then later when he created the End Avengers were put together, I mean, all those characters already had a following. So now Marvel did the same thing with their cinematic universe. They got some good movies out for all these different heroes. Then once you put them together, I mean, it's a fanboy's dream.
Right.
So Marvel has done again to DC what they did in print.
Right.
Created excitement about the characters, created good storylines that made you want to follow the characters. And it's not about special effects. It's not about the powers of the superheroes. Is about the people who are in the costumes.
Mm-hmm.
And you put that all together into one movie, like the Avengers, I mean, there was no way it couldn't be a success. Plus, you had Josh Whedon writing it, which DC let slip through their hands. We could have had a great Wonder Woman movie with Josh. So
Go ahead. Elaborate.
Brothers or somebody has had the role after they saw what Josh did with the Avengers for letting escape.
Can you elaborate on that Wonder Woman aspect, just so people that aren't in the know?
Okay, so there's been a Wonder Woman movie in development for years. They've had many different writers. Finally, just when we, fandom, thought, oh, Josh Whedon was assigned to write. He can write women. He wrote mm-hmm. Buffy. He wrote Firefly and Serenity. All these strong female characters. So that's the perfect guy you want to be writing Wonder Woman.
Right.
For some reason, Warner Brothers passed on his script. For some reason, they think it's hard to explain to an audience that you have an Amazon princess from this island of just women and that we won't get it, that the mm-hmm. audience won't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, Marvel can come out with Guardians of the Galaxy with a talking raccoon and a walking plant.
It's true.
So I think Warner Brothers just doesn't really respect the audience if they think we can't figure out Wonder Woman is. I mean, you had a successful Wonder Woman TV show, Linda Carter, that's still to this day what everybody refers to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and she still looks like she could probably play Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But in any case, I mean, for me, the most recent thing, I think Xena Warrior Princess, which my mom turned me on to,
right.
I always see that as Wonder Woman.
In
my mind, that was Wonder Woman. I mean, they mm-hmm. could have done something like that. It would have been great. So that's the Wonder Woman story.
It's interesting because when you had mentioned back in the day with the comic books of Spider-Man and, Thor popping up, I think a lot of this generation that's getting turned on the comic books forget that there was actually crossovers, like when The Incredible Hulk was a TV series. I remember Thor appearing on there, and I think even Doctor Strange made an appearance on that Incredible Hulk TV series.
I don't know about Doctor Strange, but I know Daredevil did.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and one more person. Maybe it was Doctor Strange, but I probably missed that one.
Right. So now let's go back a little bit, because we have to be. I don't want this guy to be an asterisk. We talked about Blade.
Mm-hmm.
What? First off, what was your impression of Blade first? You know, when Blade first came out, and why do you feel, or do you feel, that Blade still doesn't get the proper credit for bringing comic book IPs into the mainstream?
Well, I definitely liked Blade when it first came out, and that set a new standard for superhero films. And I think it surprised everybody, you know, how good it was, and also that it became very popular. Because it was a character that was unknown it wasn't Superman or Batman or Spider-Man or Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. And it just shows that if you have good writing, you have good production values, and you respect the material, that you can produce a good movie. And I'm only say comic book movie. I'm just saying movie, period.
Movie, yeah.
You know, so, and I'm not sure. Because the people I hang around with give
right.
Blade the respect, so I'm not sure how it is on outside my circle.
Right.
You know, whether people forget about it or not, because people do kind of go to X-Men first. I do notice that when Blade was the one that really opened the door for X-Men to happen.
X-Men. Oh, God. Anyway, part two of the show. You know, I'm getting emails here. I'm getting actually texts here on my little chat room about why I'm talking about X-Men. Okay, people, let me get this out of the way. It was from the worst, you know, they got Charles Xavier correct. They got him proper with Patrick Stewart. Little suspect on the Magneto, but whatever. He's come from the Royal Shakespeare Cinema, so he brings some skills there, you know. We can give that up. The story of Wolverine, I think if they had gotten their first choice, Russell Crowe would have been deep, but he didn't want to do the sequel. He was smart. He wanted to get a better deal. They had Dougray Scott from Mission Impossible, but he injured his ankle, so I'd love to see the footage they shot with him. So they got Hugh Jackman, who I still can't see as Wolverine. For some reason, I don't know why. But the issue for me, and I know people out there are holding their breath, their bated breath, it was the casting of Halle as Storm. And I love Halle. I know what she wants to do. But I think there they kind of looked at Storm and said, okay, she's a powerful mutant. Let's get the popular black actor to play her, and let's just focus on the other characters. And I think for me that was just the weakest link in X-Men when it came out. I just didn't see the full four post foundation of the X-Men universe. I just didn't see it. And since then, I just think it's pretty much went downhill. Since then, that's just my personal opinion. Hey, but you know, back to you. Anyway, Avengers coming out. That's done. But yet, I notice every time we have a conversation, you always seem to elaborate on Marvel may have the cinema, but DC has the TV medium. Can you speak on that, my friend?
Yeah, consistently, DC has ruled TV. I mean, with animation, live-action TV shows. I mean, it goes all the way back to George Reeves' Superman. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was on the air quite a while. And then in the 60s, you had the Batman TV show with Adam West and Burt Ward. And then in the 70s, that's when it started. I think the 60s started at the end of the 60s, 70s, started with the cartoons. Mm-hmm. And then they were on all the time, and that was great, too. I think the next thing they had was Lois and Clark. Actually, they had a Superboy show. That was really good. Well done. A lot of people forget about that.
That's right.
That wasn't canceled because it had poor viewing or poor ratings. It was canceled because Lois and Clark was going to come on. Oh, it was either Lois and Clark was going to come on or the new Superman movie was coming out, and they didn't want two Superman, you know, to be, once again, Warner, but it would be confusing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have a Superboy on TV and a Superman in the theaters or Lois and Clark would start. So I forget which one it was at the time.
Right.
But in any
right.
case, they killed that perfectly good show and went with Lois and Clark. And so since then, I mean, there's always been sort of representation of DC on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And now with Cartoon Network being under Warner Brothers' banner, I mean, there's no reason why they can't have a presence anymore. I mean, now that may change with Marvel being under the Disney banner, and they're definitely pushing that. One of the reasons Disney brought Marvel is because they wanted more of a boy audience.
Right.
They have a girl audience now with the princess films and everything, but they wanted more of that boy audience. And so Marvel was a smart buy for them to do that. And so they're definitely pushing it on Disney XD. You know, you got the cartoons all over the place.
Right. So why do you think
say all over the place because they're still on Disney Channel. You know, it seems like a somewhat different, but you have Disney, then you have Disney XD, but they're still, I mean, you have a S.H.I.E.L.D., Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on ABC, which Disney's owned also. So they're starting to expand more and more. Now they have the Netflix deal where they're going to be doing Daredevil and some other characters. So, yeah, they're starting to get out there.
So if you want to talk about, if we go to TV, we have Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. on one side, which I just really can't get into for some reason. But then on the other side, what you all have been talking about is Arrow. So why is it Arrow getting all this love? And it's kind of like when they talk about Arrow, you know, it's always thumbs up or with exclamation points. But with Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., it's kind of like, okay, ratings are down just a little bit, but they have a guest star coming in, Lady Sif. And now they're in this new show, Flash. So why do you think Arrow works where Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. doesn't? Or is it just two different aesthetics altogether? So it can't even compare. What's your vibe?
I think it's two different aesthetics in that with Arrow, the source material is really respected, and you have a lot more people who are involved in comics working on the show as producers, writers, you know, whatever. And also with Warner Brothers being behind it, you know, really giving it its full blessing. I mean, it became... right off the bat, you know, a good show because you got a nice hardcore hero, you know, very, very different from Smallville, so it had a whole different vibe to it. And I mean, it really, you really got into the characters, and also they started teasing us right away, you know, with other characters. You know, you had, you know, Laurel Lance there, and maybe she's going to become the Black Canary, but then they put the U-turn and had somebody else be the Black Canary, and the villains, you know, it was a good choice of villains that were happening. So it was really good. Very well written. And, again, it was about the characters. I think the reason Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. didn't take off as well as Arrow did was because, I mean, the first few episodes, it was confused. Like, who was the villain? I mean, there was no clear villain. It was always just somebody who just happened to get caught up in some circumstances.
Right.
So... I didn't really get a sense of good or evil or what was going on, and it seemed to be kind of floundering because the whole time I was wondering, well, where's Hydra, you know?
Right.
Their main villain.
Hail Hydra.
But they were saving that up, you know, for Captain America.
Right.
So all those episodes were kind of setting the groundwork for what would happen in Captain America, which eventually spilled over into the TV show for S.H.I.E.L.D. And then S.H.I.E.L.D. became much better because now, at first I was saying it became better after the Captain America movie, but actually, if it wasn't for those previous episodes that I had watched before, then the episodes after the Cap movie wouldn't have been as gripping because now you knew the characters, you knew how every character was supposed to interact with each other and create all this tension, which was good, dramatic tension and good character interaction also. So S.H.I.E.L.D. picked up a lot after the movie.
Right, right. Maybe I'll check it out one day. I'm still not so sure. You know, when I look at Deathlock and Deathstroke, it's just...
It's a big difference.
It's like night
again.
And day, brother. I mean, it's like night and day. And I'm not really into any of these shows. But see, I have an email here. Actually, I have a couple of questions. It's going to getting into the industry as it is. What advice do you have... maybe we should break this down with a comic book before we get into, because, you know, we do, you know, film also, but what advice do we have for cats today in terms of breaking into the industry, in terms of comic books, illustrating, penciling, whatever it may be? What would you share?
Well, now we have to define what breaking into the industry is.
Become a working artist.
No, I understand, but...
Okay, go ahead.
Because for some people, breaking into the industry is working for DC or Marvel and maybe to some small extent Dark Horse or an Image.
Right.
So other people breaking into the industry is just publishing a comic book.
Mm.
Now, now as far as it being a working artist. Mm-hmm. If you want to be a working artist, I mean, that can happen both ways. Mm-hmm. You can publish a comic book, I mean, but you're putting your money into it first. You're putting all that stuff up front first for it to happen before you get a return on it.
Right.
And that may happen, that may not happen. Also, some people just produce just for the love right now. I mean, they have their day job. Because you have a lot of people now who are in animation industry, in the film industry, mm-hmm. who grew up reading comic books. And now they have this avenue where they can publish. You have these different internet publishers, the Kablam, stuff that will produce limited runs of comic books. And, you know, printing's getting not less expensive, but it's more within the reach of a person than it would have been like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, the technology is changing, so digital makes printing a lot easier. You don't have to have film bags made mm-hmm. or plates made. So that changes the cost dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as being a working artist, again, you're taking a chance when you do it by yourself, so you may or may not become a working artist. But if you really want to become a working artist, you pretty much have to work for either DC or Marvel or a larger company that's producing comics. And Disney, I've heard rumors about Disney getting back into publishing comics, but they may not support Marvel, so
right.
I suppose suspect sooner or later you'll see the Disney characters under that line or maybe under an umbrella of Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you need comics where there's an entry point for kids. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you need an 8-year-old to discover a comic book. I mean, I feel sorry for 8-year-olds. Well, actually, 8-year-old today is a little bit more sophisticated than 8-year-olds a few years ago. So
right.
Maybe I shouldn't feel so sorry for them. I mean, some of the video games they play.
Oh, my God.
But still, I still feel a little regret in some way that an 8-year-old can't experience a comic that's aimed at them where it's just fun. You know, I mean, everything's just become so dark and serious and, you know, anti-heroes. I mean, I think it's good to have Archie Comics slot. It was still one of the best-selling lines in comics. But, you know, you need other entry points. You need the Disney stuff out there, Mickey Mouse, whatever, and other things. You know, I'm racking my brain right now to try to think of something modern that I would give an 8-year-old.
You know, they're reading Hunger Games. So
yeah.
That's what it seems like, the thick novels. So.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. When you're at Comic Con or something like that, or you see the portfolio reviews, and say you're at the table and the line's long,
mm-hmm.
and the next person now seeing number 48, their person walks up to you. What do you want to see? Say it's a penciler. What do you want to see in that portfolio that would make you want to give them some? You'll give, because you've always given positive support and critique. Not criticism, but you give positive observation of their work. But what should be in that portfolio, quality of work? What should they have to really have a chance to come work with, say, ABBA Studios?
Well, the first thing for the portfolio is you only have 12 to 15 pieces in it, and maybe 12 nowadays because the internet makes people a little bit more attention deprived.
Mm.
So 12 at the most. That's it. You don't need to bring everything you've ever drawn in your life. Should all be organized inside sleeves. Nothing should be hanging out pockets. Oh yeah, here's this and stuff falling out. Should be very professional and organized. And buy a portfolio from the art store. They're already there for you. And comic books is about telling a story. It's not about doing pinups. You'll get the chance to do pinups and covers if they hire you. You'll get that later. You don't need to put that in your portfolio now. So what you want to do is show different moods, different themes, different genres. So within those 12 pages, break it down to 3 or 4 pages and have one complete sequence of 3 pages. So maybe 3 pages of just regular people, another 3 pages maybe with some superhero action, maybe another 3 pages with a Western, maybe another 3 pages that's, you know, dark and gritty. Maybe another 3 pages that has humor. You know, show your range, show what you can do. But above all, each sequence, each set of pages has to tell one complete story. And I'm not talking about, you know, a beginning, middle, or end, but within that sequence, like, for instance, if you just look at a comic book and you think I could tell the story better than that. Pick the three weakest pages and tell that story better in your portfolio.
Right. I like that. Say that one more time.
What, the whole thing or the last one?
Oh, not the whole thing. I just like the part where you had mentioned. We had mentioned, if you think you could do it better, get that weakest part and give me three pages of that. That I like.
Yeah.
That I like.
Yeah.
That
I like. I mean, because a lot of times people think they have to have a script. Somebody needs to write a script for them. And that's a problem, too, because if you're with an amateur writer who hasn't had anything published, that writer is still struggling through telling the story also. So your his or her mistakes are going to be repeated when you draw it.
Right.
I mean, so the best thing to do, and it's something that you don't have to, you don't got to wait for, because you already have comic books in your house if you're interested in it. Like I said, just find three pages that you think you can draw better. And tell that story, those three pages, better. I mean, and there are scripts available online, some professional scripts. The thing is that I think people don't make good choices when they choose what pages they want to do.
The fight scene.
Yeah. I mean, you have to choose, the artist has to choose something that's going to showcase their work. And it can't be, they can't feel like tied down or have to do what the script said. When I'm looking at a portfolio, when editors looking at portfolios, they're not reading the script. They're looking at your work. Being evaluated on how you tell the story as an artist, not on what somebody wrote. I mean, even when I got in, I mean, the first script I got, I started changing things because to make the story flow better, because that's my job.
But now,
right from the beginning, I was a hard head.
Well, if I could add some stuff on the writing side, a little feedback to, since you brought that up, you're probably going to be cringing when you brought that up. People out there in the world of this diaspora of creativity, lend me your ears and let me say this. Just because it looks like a script does not mean it's good. And just because you got final draft does not mean it's a script. You must understand the process of writing. You must respect the process of writing, and you must be able to write to tell a story. There is not a simple thing of 1, 2, 3. There has to be some substance in there. I just had to put that in there for the writers because, you know.
No, that's good. That's good, because some people think, oh, they got the software, like you said, final draft. Hey, I'm a writer.
No. And I will say why, because when I have done script readings for several film festivals, which I definitely enjoy, you can usually tell who bought the script software and just had an idea versus who's submitting their 19th draft, because it's just so deep. People, writing involves, first off, you have to know the story you're writing. Don't look at X-Men and try to do something like that. Don't look at ABBA Studios' work and try to do something like that. What story do you as a writer want to write? Now, do you know have you done research on what you want to write? Because there's nothing worse than a soulless script when it's just information, but there's no soul to it. There's no reason to turn the page. There's no reason to even pick it up in the first place. Okay, that's my tangent right now for writers. We'll do that in our next show. This is really about you, the artist, so I'll be quiet. So, Mr. Simpson, some time ago, and you're working on this now, we collaborated on a project. You came out as a director and things like that. And we collaborate on a project called Border Clash. So how about you shed some light on your directing work on that, please?
It was very exciting to be involved in the project. I mean, Saeed wrote it. He's being humble here.
Your show, man.
You know, it's very good to work on something. And it's a fan film, so it's featuring Misty Nanico Ling Wing, who have been called various names, Daughters of the Dragon, now Heroes for Hire. And again, as people who are into comics, and we respect the material, so we respect the characters, and that's how we approached it. And that's how I approach it, as to bring out the characters, bring out their motivations, you know. So while the actors and actresses, you know, they didn't read these particular books, now, I was there to say, okay, well, this is the situation between you and this character. This is why you hate each other. So So because I had that knowledge as a director, I was able to give that to them, so their motivations, you know, were set when they're doing the scene, so they fully understand what I'm trying to get across. So, you know, so I'm not acting anything out for them, but I'm just letting them know what feelings they should be expressing and what's behind the thing. So I'm giving them some substance to the words that they're saying, so that,
right,
so that they come out with some truth to them. And I think y'all did an excellent job of that. I mean, because watching, we just finished, we're just on the final edit for our first episode, which will be releasing soon for all the public to see.
Right.
And just watching it again, I'm just so proud of the work that the actors did on this. I mean, because it's just really good. They really did a good job.
Yeah. Coya Webb. Can we actually speak who's in the first episode, or don't say nothing?
give him Koya, Tamiko Brownlee.
Okay, yeah,
Javon,
we can
Johnson.
Oh my God, Javon Johnson, Tamiko Brownlee, vicious martial artist, I think she's Avatar or Airbender. I mean, my gosh, she's so. We love you, my dear, Javon Johnson, who actually flew in to do a scene, so he came in and nailed it as usual. Koya Webb, oh my God, I mean. So he let it slip. Yes, Misty's in there, and Koya Webb does Misty Knight proper. All right, we're not talking proper. So yeah, it was fun. I think it helped, because you touched on something. It really helped you lensing it, because you already knew. It was like you was talking about how Josh did Serenity and those kind of characters.
Mm-hmm.
You knew these characters, and I think the one thing I admire is how you were able to convey to folks who don't even know the characters, okay, this is what this character is feeling, this is the backstory of why they're feeling this, and this is why they're reacting, and how Tamiko, I think you pronounced it, and Koi and Javon just went with it. I took it as though, and maybe you can disagree, but I took it as though, because as you said, you knew the genre. How much did that really help with people who don't even know these? To them, it's just comic book characters. How did it help? You brought soul to it, from what I saw. And I'm being, you're being very humble yourself, so let's get it out there.
I mean, just like Josh wrote and directed Avengers, I storyboarded and directed Border Clash. Mm-hmm. So I was very close to the vision, I mean, from what Saeed wrote. So, and because we're both, you know, from that background with comic books, you know, it was just a good synergy. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not the type of comic book fan who has to quote chapter and verse and issue this, and you know, that wouldn't mean anything to the actors.
Right,
I just gave
right.
them what they needed to know for the scene. You know, when I'm amongst my own people, then we could do, you know, in issue number 5 on
panel
page
four.
3, this is what happened. Yeah. You know, but when you're amongst people who don't know that, you know, there's no need to geek out like that.
right. So true.
It was definitely, and it was good because it felt like, it really felt like I was bringing the characters to life, you know, through these actors, and by giving them the motivations, you know, I knew we could be as close and as true to the characters as possible. I mean, because when you're true to something, that's what an audience will respond to. They respond to truth.
Right.
If an artist or creator is not true to themselves, then the audience is not going to respond to that. They're not going to want to see it. It's just going to fall flat.
Right.
You know, if you're just doing something for money, if you're just doing something to hop onto a fad, no, it's not going to work. It's never going to fly.
Right.
You
right.
may get
right.
some suckers. But you're not going to get an audience that's going to be loyal to you. You're not going to be an audience that's going to grow. You know, so we did something in truth, you know, with these characters. We didn't make a fan film just to make a fan film. We made it because we are fans, and we want to see these characters get some proper exposure and done properly, too.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think the sweetness of it was that it was not just, you know, some IP property to the company. I had to slide my own characters in there because just to show a little balance and whatnot. Because I have to give a shout-out to Carrie Yoder, who was doing her thing, and, you know, oh, my God, Jesse Graff, who's upstairs, Tia, we have to give some love to, and, you know, Colette was there. But Yes, I think it was being a fan of it really, you know, really, really just, you know, there was an inherent love to the whole group that I saw there. And I just think it was a blast, and I definitely can't wait till that first episode comes out and they see, you know, your directorial debut, because I think you've directed before, but in this genre, I'm going to say it since, you know, hey, I was there, so I was the whole thing. Now, there's another project we actually collaborated on that we just released, I believe, like an hour ago, Grace Fallen Angel, where you had the artistic liberties to really get down. And the way you approach that project, for those that don't know, you know, send me an email or find me on Facebook or find Howard. He'll give you his contact before we get off the air. But it's a story about an angel of God coming to earth at the despair of a young lady, how she sees society being dark and, as Howard mentioned earlier, dark and destructive. And that's all I'll say. But with my writing, as the words came from God, I gave it to you to illustrate it and do your flavor. But what was supposed to be a 12-pager ended up being a 51-pager. And the style you did was almost a hybrid of so many. What was your approach to that project?
Actually, I did do it as 12 pages initially.
Right.
Standard comic book size.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as I looked at it, I said, you know, it just bored me, you know. And I thought about another project I'd done for internet, Game When the Internet Was Young, and I was trying to do something different. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, I'm going to do it in that style, and I'm going to do it where the pages are a little bit more interactive. The panels appear when I need them to appear, when I want them to appear, because now with the internet, I don't have to have everything be on one page at the same time. You know,
right.
I can pace it. I can speed it up, slow it down. You know, I can reveal what I want to reveal when it needs to be revealed and keep things hidden. And so that's, you know, how I approached it. So basically I broke it down so that it's kind of, I hesitate to use the word animated because there really is no animation in it, but it's just
right.
That the panels build upon themselves, you know, for the story to happen. And now, you know, I could have one panel, because also there's a thing where in comics, on the printed page, there's no way to express time, and we have to use tricks to express time.
Right.
I mean, because when the character is speaking and the character is answering, I mean, there are two moments of time happening there.
Right.
But at the same time, I may be drawing another action, you know, that has to happen, you know, so I could get to the next panel and set that up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I didn't have to. I wasn't constrained by that. Now I can have a character talk and say what they need to say, and didn't have the other character respond, and I can move the panel along. And I mean, until people see this may not sound like this makes any sense at all.
Right.
But really, I think it needs to be experienced to be appreciated, and I think they will appreciate it. I do this in a different style than I normally draw. I didn't draw in a lot of detail, and didn't draw it too realistically. I mean, there was some realism in it, but I saved those moments because now I felt unrestrained. I didn't feel like I had to stick with one style while I'm drawing. And I try to have the sections have different moods to them. You know, one was kind of like the childhood innocence, and then another section where, you know, the reality of the world just hits you. And a few things I did storytelling wise where I put a big border around, you know, the childhood innocence stuff because, you know, she's protected at that point, you know, still had that innocence in the world. And then once that protection is removed, and once what's happening in the world is exposed to that, that outer border disappears, you know, because she's exposed now. Now it's not just this fairy tale world. What if this happens? Wish this could happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I say any more, I'm gonna give it away.
Right.
So I think I better stop there because I was about to say something.
Walk the line, brother. Walk the line. Know the ledge, as Rockin.
Yeah,
know the ledge.
So I'm tiptoeing right now, so I think I better stop right there because I want people to experience themselves.
Creativity, you had touched on, which actually I found that when I first came into the game of writing and publishing my own stuff, and I would check out other comic book strips, because I write screenplay books. I'm coming from the film side, so I even with a comic book or graphic novel, I write like a screenplay. But I know when I would see when I would actually come across some comic book scripts, it seemed to say, okay, Batman walks in, panel one. Okay, panel two, Batman sits down. And it just seemed like prison. And I know we have to be creative, a little bit creative freedom. So I know on this one, my statement to you was like, draw how you flow it. How did it feel? And you touched on it just a little bit a few seconds ago, or a few minutes ago. How did it feel to have that kind of liberty to bring your vision? You know, like, you know, how are the legs too long? You know, can you make it a little more sexy? How did it feel to have that liberty, that freedom?
It's always good to have freedom. But, I mean, I was still restrained by the comic book medium. And so the freedom that I experienced was just in my approach to it.
Right.
Because I still have to tell a story and I still have to tell panel-to-panel continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way I approached it, I'm again thinking about different things and thinking about, you know, a limited color palette, you know, how I was drawing it and when I would draw realistic, when I wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where, you know, I experienced some creativity. I mean, because even though you're saying panel one, Batman walks in, panel two, Batman sits down, there's still a huge amount of creativity that can happen there.
Mm-hmm.
Again, because it's easy to be creative and free when you have no rules or limitations. But
right.
I feel as an artist, the limitations really bring out the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
what happened here. Because mm-hmm. when I first did it as a 12-page comic, I felt limited.
Right.
And I wanted to break out. And that's what I did. So it's still a comic book, but it's more a comic book for the internet age, not for the print age.
Right. It's interesting because we have the same thing, or I say all the time, the less you have to work with, the more creative you'll be. And I think
mm-hmm.
about film, how the 70s and 80s, and I know this is like, you know, birth of a nation for this generation, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
the 70s, you know, you had Serpico, Godfather, and all those movies, and even the first Star Wars, when the technology wasn't there, you know, you were forced to tell the story, which I think is why a lot of international films work, because they focus more on the story, and the special effects is just to help the story, you know, something like a Blade Runner, versus today, where it seems like let's use this camera, let's shoot on this, and let's get all this effects in, blah, blah, blah. But where's the story? You know what I mean? And
Yeah, I mean, let's go all the way back to the movie serials from the 30s, the black and white. I mean, I mean, you really had shoestring special effects, and they probably were using shoestrings for some of them.
They actually had the shoe. The string was extra.
Yeah. You know, the shoestring is making Superman fly or something. You know?
Oh, that's right.
Or, you know, Flash Gordon's spaceship. You know, you can actually see the string, you know.
Shooting out of space and it drops straight down with the smoke coming out the back. Yeah, in
yeah,
space.
Yeah.
But I believe
so,
it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, you know. So those three, and I mean, we weren't born during those times when those serials were made, those black and white in the 30s. I mean, but we saw them as kids. It's like, wow, you know, because, you know, reruns, I mean, it's called a syndication now. And it's like, wow, yeah, that's so cool. But, you know, again, there was an honesty to it because that's what they could do at the time.
Right.
So that's what, you know, looked good. So, and again, the story was important, you know, because it didn't have a lot of special effects. It couldn't do space very well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you believed that rocket was flying through, you know, because
mm-hmm.
you suspended your disbelief so you could enjoy the story.
Right.
I mean, sometimes nowadays, even with, you know, all this computer graphics and the effects that they can do, sometimes you can't even suspend your belief so you can enjoy the story because it screams so much that it's computer graphics and it just takes you out of the enjoyment of the film or the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it has to, and I think they're finally reaching a point where, you know, they're dialing it down so that it's integrated into the whole. And I think Avengers was a perfect example of that. I mean, because there was not one point that I thought about computer graphics in the whole movie.
Right.
I mean, I just enjoyed the movie. I wasn't thinking about, ooh, that's a good effect.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking about that when we Captain America Winter Soldier. You know, you know,
same
I
thing.
I think it's been out long enough so I can actually say a couple of scenes, but, you know, the scene where You know, first off, the way they introduced him was like, if you didn't read a comic book, you could tell this guy was about death and destruction. But mm-hmm. he wasn't, Black Widow was supposed to be, I'm every woman, whatever. But then when Winter Soldier showed up, get out the way, right? And he shot her. But then after mm-hmm. all that mass destruction, let's kidnap Fury, they still had that scene where he was strapped to the chair and they had to wipe his memory. And you could just hear mm-hmm. the scream of anguish where he was pretty much treated like a thing, not a villain. And I know maybe some people may look and say, yeah, whatever. But me as a writer, it shows a little depth to that character. Even towards the end when he struggled, I'm not going to fight you. And he's still like, well, I'm going to kill you anyway. But he still had that inner conflict. And then they went comic book style or genre style where as Captain America is drowning, Winter Soldier, the hand comes down, he drags him on the beach, and not even giving life to life, he just walks off. That's gangster. Mm-hmm. And for me, yeah. that's not special effects. That's writing. For me, that's writing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, Don't get me started. No, it's okay. We let's go old school. Godzilla. We checked it out lately. Why do you think that worked, or if you think it worked, what was your five? Not a lot of effects, considering, I think, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, not a lot of effects that are obvious. Mm-hmm. I definitely liked the new Godzilla movie, and I felt they followed the Japanese formula for the film, and that's what's worked with Godzilla in the past, so that was cool. And it was good seeing, with updated effects, and I think they respected the material. And they also brought it to present day. Actually, they made it so that the 1954 Godzilla happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really good. So it wasn't like we were watching a new Godzilla. This was the same Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
Just more in his story, which is pretty much the Japanese have been doing all along. It's been added on to the story, So.
Right. Oh, well.
Yeah,
here's something for you. Here's a respect to the old series. Apparently, I don't have the name right, whatever, but the lead mm-hmm. from the original film, 54, was actually, mm-hmm. they shot a scene for him in this film, and because mm-hmm. the director said, I have to get him in there, but for somehow it didn't test right, and they wanted to get more to, let's get to the action, get the scene out, so they had to cut the scene out, but they actually had the guy from the original film. Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
Respect, but I must also give a shout out.
I hope to see that in the DVD.
I'll be looking for that one, because that would have been like, the bridge between the two generations. That would have been so much respect. But just even get a little deeper, I have to give a shout out to a good friend of mine, TJ Storm, because apparently he did the motion capture for Godzilla.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, it's on his Facebook. Check him out, people. T, letter T, J Storm. No J-A-Y, just TJ and Storm. Yeah, he did. I found yesterday he did a motion capture for Godzilla. So I'm like, okay, now I know Godzilla. Yeah, man. All right. Hey, before we forget, I don't want to rush it out. We always have some close-out music. We have about 14 minutes left. How can people reach out to you? I have another question here, but how can people reach out to you? How can they locate you?
You can definitely contact me through my website, which is abadabba.com. So it's A, D as in boy, B as in boy, A, D as in dog, A, B as in boy, B as in boy, A, abadabba. Spelled the same backwards and forwards. And all my social media links are there. You can see a lot of my art and other comics that I'm doing currently, because most of the comics I'm doing now are on the internet, even though I have one coming out soon. But I don't know when that's coming out, so I can't promote it yet. so that's the best way to contact me, through my website, abadabba.com. So you can email me, connect with me on social media, let me know you heard the show, and give me your thoughts, comment,
mm-hmm.
and start a dialogue. That's the beauty of the internet now. Start a dialogue.
Yeah, and it seems like you do a lot of social media. Is there any sites out there you want to recommend for the creators out there, outside of ABBA? Anything you want to... Well, you have a blog, though. I'm sorry, you have a blog, don't you?
Yeah, I have a blog, and there's a link to it. It's called Just Create. And there's a link to that from my website where I talk about creating comic books, going deep. I mean, if you start right from the beginning, it's cumulative knowledge, so.
How'd that come about?
I definitely highly recommend it. Because I want a resource there for people, because I saw there was a lot of different things, like all kind of directed. So I just wanted one massive thing that would be a good place for anybody to go for any information. So I looked to other sites because, you know, I don't know everything in the world. And I mean, there are people who do lettering much better than I do, so I linked it to letterers. And I haven't gotten to colorists yet, but this is coming.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
so I
want
to be a repository for all the good stuff, too. You know, I know a lot, but other people know some stuff, too, so I want to be a one-stop shop for all the information you need about comics.
Yeah, and speaking of your coloring stuff, I'd be fail to admit that you actually colored the my Alien Dance series, which I have to release actually in 2 days. So the thing about your coloring style is that, you know, there's a myriad of lettering styles, the coloring style you use was very unique in reference to the genre, but not unique if you know international palettes when it comes to coloring and things like that. But Howard, with your blog and stuff like that, there's this, I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't ask your perspective on this, and we may have touched on it before some time ago, but there's always this saying that these IP movies, these comic book films and stuff like that, eventually is going to implode. But I believe you said you don't see that happening, if I have that correct. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, because ever since the Christopher Reeve Superman movies, people have been saying, okay, people are tired of comic book movies, not going to happen. But it's always going to happen. I mean, especially now, they're not going to stop doing it because now you have second and third generations of fans who have grown up drawing comics. And not only that, but those second and third generation are the creators of the films. They're the writers, they're the directors, they're the producers. So just like I have fun, you know, creating this fan film, they're having fun creating these big feature films or even
right.
the TV shows or even the animation.
Right.
You know, so it's like reliving your childhood again. So it's not going to die. And people, and as long as the stories are good, it doesn't matter. It's not a comic book film. It's a well-told story.
Right.
On film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
films
why
you...
I don't think it's going to die.
Why do you think people would
in
say
films?
That? Why do you think in films? Why do you think people would say that? Or do you think it's just a common, maybe they're looking at comic books, how the market's kind of shrinking and things like that? Or why do you think people would say that? You know,
well, there's
making
always
money?
A backlash. Yeah, there's always a backlash against genres. I mean, for a long time, science fiction sold, you know, during the 50s. And then science fiction, nobody wants science fiction films anymore. And now science fiction films are back. Then you had epic films, the biblical epic films. You know, that sold for a while. Then they said, okay, well, nobody's buying it. People just have a few bonds, and then they think, okay, there's no audience for that anymore. But now you're getting biblical epic films being filmed, shown again. Mm-hmm. So everything goes in cycles. I mean, even if comics stop, movies stop, or books based on comic movies, even if films based on comic books, you know, stop for a while, they'll always be back.
Yeah, yeah. Any film you're looking forward to see that's coming out or you've seen lately or on the horizon, anything you're waiting for?
In comic book characters?
Yeah, we'll say film-wise. Yeah, just film, yeah.
Yeah, I will have to look at my list. I got my wish list on Flickr or Flickster.
Right.
So I don't remember things off the top of my head anymore because now I can go look at it. What's my wish for next? I can't think of anything off the top of my head right now, which is really sad. It just shows how much internet technology has changed. I don't remember things. I don't have to remember. I don't carry it around in my head. It's useless information. I can go look it up.
Are you looking forward to Days of Future? Days of Future Past coming out? I think it's Friday.
No, I'm not really looking forward to that. I don't have high hopes for it.
Why is that, man?
I do not have high hopes for it. Because it looks like they just threw a lot of stuff in there and they're trying to cover too much and they're changing the story too much. The dynamics aren't the same.
Mm-hmm.
So as a comic book fan, I'm not looking forward to it. Now, I'm not a purist. So everything I see on the film or TV or cartoon doesn't have to match exactly with the comic book. Because that would be kind of boring, too, because I already know the story and I already know what's going to happen. You know, I want them to take a chance. I want them to expand the storyline. But this one, it just seems like it just disrespected the whole storyline. There's no sense in doing it if you're not going to do it right.
Right.
And this one doesn't have the feeling that it's being done right. It just feels like there's stank on it.
Yeah, I definitely have to concur with that. I think the thing that gets me, you know, and again, I'm not a purist. It doesn't have to be like, you know, line for line, you know, like I know with Iron Man, I think it was Iron Man 2, that scene where he's talking to his father's hologram or recording.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's, let me ask this question first. And this leads into why I brought that point up. When you actually read comics and graphic novels, do you look at it as an artist in terms of they could have drawn this better, or do you submerge yourself into what you're reading?
I never look at it as artist because since comic book inspired me to draw,
mm-hmm.
I was always drawing while I was reading them, so I never looked at it in that way. Mm-hmm. So I can read a comic without critiquing it in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Now upon the second or third read, then I'll start looking at it from a professional standpoint.
Right.
And thinking about, you know, how I look at how some storytelling things they've done or what works, what doesn't. You know, think about what I would have done, or it'll inspire me to do something else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I can read a comic book on two different levels.
Okay. I was asking because when I brought the Iron Man thing, I remember and I was reminded that since I write, I tend to look at the writing of whatever movie I go look. And I remember knowing Demon in a Bottle, that classic Iron Man story back in the day that introduced War Machine, you know, and then knowing that how he was kind of down and he saw his dad, I felt like in Iron Man 2, okay, I don't know if Disney got Marvel at that time, I think it was a little after, but that was an opportunity to really go deep into that character of not just if Tony Stark being this smart mouth billionaire mm-hmm. playboy. But now here's the vulnerability if he lost Pepper. So for mm-hmm. me, so I bring that up because we're not really, we don't need to see panel for panel, but when I look at Days of Future Past, I just see, I'm definitely going to check it out, but I just see a lot of mm-hmm. noise there versus I think we had just checked out Spider-Man late week, couple of days ago, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And you were pointing out things in there because you know that series better than I did that I didn't recognize. Particularly you said, hey, she's wearing the death outfit. I'm like, oh, damn, she is. But, you know, it seemed to that wasn't panel for panel, but still they went to the crescendo of her death.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, right?
Yeah,
so does
yeah
it mean,
definitely.
So that shows that you don't have to be a purist, you know, panel for panel replication of what the book said, but it seems like something was Days of Future Past. It's like you were saying, it just seems too much for a story that was really about a girl going back in time to change the future.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now it's
yeah,
like,
we lost that.
Like the whole thing.
I don't know what it's going to be about now.
I don't know. Wolverine goes back.
How is
it
going to be a character study?
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, they're going to get my money anyway.
Yeah,
but, you know,
yeah,
Demon in the Bottle, I mean, that's a good thing to bring up. I mean, for people who read it, I mean, that's a very strong storyline done by Bob Layton and David Michelinie. And I thought they were going there in the second Iron Man movie, and it was a missed opportunity to dance all around it.
yeah. Christopher Nolan would have done it because my attitude was like, let Iron Man come flying in. You know, there's that last suit that Whiplash had that was ticking, and there's Pepper
mm-hmm.
over there, tick, tick, tick. And just as he comes in, boom, Pepper gets blown to smithereens, to ashes, and that's a perfect lead-in to right into part three. Because not only is it just that,
mm-hmm.
he has to deal with what happened in Avengers on top of that. Oh, man. It, mm-hmm. it would have shown such a depth. It was a missed opportunity. I'm just, to this day, I can't watch that movie.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, brother, we are at the end of our show here. You know we have to do a part two. You know we have to do a part two.
Okay.
Get some stuff. But I want to give a shout-out to you, man, you know, and your crew over there at ABBA. You know, much love. Thanks for, you know, stopping in. Thanks for taking the time, and, you know, thanks for being patient with our technical difficulties. As Joker said, we're small, but there's room for growth. Hey, man,
that's
so I'll let you go, and I'm going to play some exit music, and, you know, you can do your thing. And, hey, man, let's set up part two when you come back to L.A. and make it happen, man. I want to thank you for your time.
All right.
And all you listeners out there, I'm sorry I didn't get to all your questions. We will do a part two. And I'll have your questions printed out, and I'll read them off to Mr. Simpson, and we'll take it. Maybe we'll do your Q&As and things like that. But, Howard, thanks for your time, man, and you have a great evening, man.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you also.
All right.
Bye.
Peace out, my man. All right, people, that was my man there, Mr. Simpson. Thanks for tuning in. I definitely want to give you a shout-out to all you guys. Thanks for your patience as we're going through the technical difficulty. Let me lay in some exit music here, and when we do part two, I'll definitely make sure you know about it ahead of time. In the interim, let's give a little pop, a little love, you know, and stuff like that, and have some fun, all right? Tupac, take us out one day at a time.
Mind full of demons, I don't wanna hear them anymore. Got me heartbroken, fine. So many babies screaming cause they singing destruction before they see a human being. So they start smoking weak, we'll never get our day until we learn to pray. Keep our families in check cause they all broken. Why do ghetto birds die before we learn to fly? Somebody else's staff cooking guns, smoking weak, can all make a change. So I'm told, but I haven't seen the change unfold. I keep hoping, please, if you prefer to breathe. Communities in need of people that believe. Keep your eyes open, I can only say I'll try until the day I die. I promise to be wise with my heart open, greed. Bring lonely misery, away to tragedy. So I stay sucker free, only a few chosen rise. My ghetto queen, rise, don't be afraid to try. Too many of us die for the door to open. Wise, my brothers be wise. Stay focused on the prize, though everybody dies.
We can only learn to take our anger and our hate. Control our mental state, settle down and set it straight. Maybe we can learn to take a second to pump the brakes before we set it to rest later and let it escalate. Cause by then it's just too late. There's so much we can take, and there's only so much someone can swallow or tolerate. Up to the point that it just breaks, snaps, and that's all it takes. You think that we was learning from other rappers' mistakes, but we ain't. It's brain to go against. With every artist comes an image he portrays and a picture that he paints. But in the midst of all this anger and this angst, never once did you hear me say I'm a gangster, and I ain't hear no complaints. But I know that I will always continue to grow, long as I lead and never follow no one else's shadow. There will never be another me, and that I can guarantee. That's why the fuck I remain sucker free to this day. The game will never be the same, no matter how much fame or success they attain. There will never be another me, and no matter what they do, there will never be another you. You can search but you'll never find. You can try to rewind time, but in your hearts and your minds, we will never die. We are forever alive and we continue growing.
One day at a time.
Don't get caught in the publicity and caught in the hype. Rappers are regular people minus money and light. Searching for fortune and fame and superstardom. All the jury, all the calls, whose crews are hardest. Now the hip-hop police, surveillance is watching. And the kids think peace is their only option. Outlaws born filthy, guilty as charged. My memories are gonna die. My Machiavelli is gone. You think the industry is fun? Ain't no pity with guns. And when your money is up, that's when your enemies come. So if he died and came back, would he try to save? Rap, we needin' to change, the drama remains.
I spent my whole life, yeah, fighting myself, that I can't win, so I'm inviting some help, and hey now then, I take rights from the left, I'm still, like a kid looking for stripes on my belt, yeah, that day is a fight in itself, so I just pray and hope God, take a life to myself, no matter how much I try, stay alive, I'ma die, man, still standing and in love with my pride.
Frivolous bitch, we passed that. I'm trying to keep some income coming in and collect on my ass cap. But rappers in the game ain't changed. And I finally realized that we not in the same game. The hating the never end, so I guess I deal with it. The 4-5 cop killers, yes, I'm still with it. The streets is military, you gotta be a soldier. Gotta stay leery and keep your eyes on the road as they do what they gotta do. The shackle and hold is what we gotta do. We gotta do to keep growing one way at a time. Keep the faith in your mind and we continue growing.
One day at a time.